Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige podcast. Today, we're doing the 1971 The French Connection. I guess we're on a Gene Hackman kick after Hoosiers. This movie, we just missed its 50th anniversary, too. It came out in October of 1971. It's directed by William Friedkin, who also did 1973's The Exorcist. He also did Blue Chips, which is a Nick Nolte film. It's a lightly fictionalized account of Bobby Knight, as far as I can tell. This is where I remember watching as a kid. And Rules of Engagement, which is some kind of army film involving Tommy Lee Jones and Sam Jackson that I have not seen. It's a screenplay based on Ernest Tiedemann, best known for his novels featuring the African-American detective John Shaft. Shaft! Something of a bad motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on The French Connection by Robin Moore, which purports to be a true story of drugs, crime in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s. It stars Gene Hackman as Detective Jimmy Popeye Doyle and Rob Scheider as Detective Buddy Cloudy Russo. This film is interesting to me because, number one, we were kind of interested in doing some Hackman stuff, seeing some of the Hackman's prime.
Mm-hmm.
And two, this thing was constantly name-checked by Vince Gilligan on the Breaking Bad podcast. Like, every time there was a Walt and Hank scene in particular. In fact, I think that this was some, there was the, this actually came up on the show. Like, Hank and Walt were discussing that scene where Popeye just misses the guy in the train and the guy smiles and waves. And that was constantly mentioned as like some of the inspiration of the tension of those scenes. What did you think when you sat down to watch this 50-year-old movie?
I had heard of it before. And so, you know, I knew it was a well-respected movie of its era. I didn't really know what year it was. I wasn't sure if it was like before Jaws, Scheider, after Jaws, Scheider. This might be the only other movie I've ever seen him in, but I didn't know much about it. I knew that it was, you know, cops and detectives, whatever, trying to catch a criminal, but I didn't know that its reputation was, hey, it has some of the best chase scenes and some of the best like cat and mouse stuff of the era. And so I guess I was impressed by that part of it and sort of impressed by the style of it. I think it does have a very kinetic style in its chase scenes.
Oh yeah. And also that's the word, kinetic.
The music lends like a lot of that vibe to it. I really like the music, but overall I didn't care much for this movie. It wasn't doing a lot. I've seen 1,000 movies just like this since that have done it better, have built on what The French Connection did in ways that impressed me far more than anything this movie could do because it's 50 years old, you know?
Yeah, I think that I largely agree. I thought this movie got started slow. And I also, throughout the first 30 or 40 minutes, I kept on thinking, am I missing something? Am I missing something? Because the plot is told in a not very handholdy kind of way.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And I kept on like, and I felt like I was constantly missing something because there's French subtitle stuff and there's like, I had a hard time. And then the people are referring to these characters by name and they're pronounced differently in French than they are like out of Gene Hackman's mouth. And like
sure.
I felt a little hard to follow, but no, I think I got all the plot. But yeah, the pacing's interesting because it is relentless. Like this is, you know, once the movie gets going, like 15 minutes into it, it's essentially one long chase scene.
Yeah.
That like, as Robert Ebert says, sometimes the pace accelerates, sometimes it slows down, sometimes it goes breakneck, but it's just always like this constant hunt, this constant hunt. And I thought that was interesting. And I thought that, the visual style, like there's some really like even today would be impressive shots of like, you know, dolly shots of Gene Hackman running down a crowded Manhattan subway tunnel. And, you know, the field craft, the spy craft of like tailing someone, making someone, all that stuff I thought was done really well. And then, of course, when it comes to car chase, this has got one of the you know, top five car chases, and it's a novel one because I was expecting like a bullet style, Matt Damon, you know, like one guy chasing another or one guy trying to get away from the cops. Did not anticipate seeing someone racing an L train.
Yeah.
But holy hell, it's a great chase despite that. But yeah, there was something a little kind of cold and bloodless. Plus, like, there's also something, there's a little bit of like what feels like naivete in this movie. 50 years on from the war on drugs and all that stuff, there's a little bit of like kind of naive, but then it also is kind of like grows up in a hurry in the last 5 minutes of the film, as like, you know, you really see Gene Hackman's character compromised, and then the after, you know, the what do they call those things where they have like the story cards that flash at the end that tell you how everybody thing winded up. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a pretty cynical modern take on a crime film. Why the fuck did, you know, how did the war on drugs like get out of its first 10 years of existence? People knew it was this futile.
Because films don't make law, I guess.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. Apparently don't do a damn thing to influence public opinion either. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed that. But the thing I enjoyed the most was the clear references and inspirations from one of my favorite television shows of all time, Breaking Bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to start? Maybe we should just give a loose outline of the plot for Pico. I imagine there's a lot of people who haven't seen this film.
Yeah.
And it is like one that's like, you know, it's like hard to recommend, but I do think if you want to see a movie that influenced so many, you know, modern crime films, there you will see it here. And there's enough. Like I said, the car chase alone is kind of worth the price of admission.
Mm-hmm.
This is a film about the early days of the drug wars in the 60s and 70s. They're trying to interdict the heroin entering into New York. And apparently a lot of this heroin was coming in through France in various different ways. And this is purports to be a real life story of a narcotics officer in New York that's working to shut down this French connection. And it's like a condensed version of The Wire. You've got wiretapping, you've got, you know, people eavesdropping on conversations, you got people following and looking for drops, you got people tearing apart cars looking for drugs, you got fist fights and shootouts. Holy shit, there's actually a almost like a Vietnam battalion war scene in the middle of this film between the cops and robbers. And that's it. Will Gene Hackman catch the bad guy?
Mm-hmm.
Are there bad guys? Are there good guys? Is a modern crime enforcement and justice system even a thing? Let's talk about the film. I want to talk about the Breaking Bad stuff.
Okay.
What all homages and inspirations jumped out at you?
I'm pretty sure Gene Hackman's wearing a pork pie hat in this. Am I wrong about that? Or is this like a, it's very similar.
No, I'm not sure if I remember Vince Gilligan specifically citing the inspiration, but he essentially took the hero in this movie and gave him and gave it to the bad guy.
Yeah.
Gave it to Heisenberg. But the Heisenberg hat is on display through like it's 90% of the time Gene Hackman's wearing it on his damn head.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure I can't remember what Mike's car is in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, but I swear one of these cars is the exact car, because these are all,
someone might have driven an LTD, a limited. Yeah. The other thing is like just the dynamic between Hank and Walt. Like, mm-hmm. Hank is a lot like Gene Hackman. Like, when you're introduced to Hank, Hank is sloppy, Hank is lazy, Hank is content to rip and roll minor meth dealers, you know, they're just out of high school and they're dumb. They don't know what they're doing. And I feel like they are painting a picture of Popeye Doyle as that too, that he's just, you know, he's fucked up bus and he's fucked up evidence and he's maybe too violent. And he's not a very good cop and he's having extraordinary pressure to get a big bust, or what, he's going to be transferred, or he's in some kind of nebulous trouble with the cop. And that reminded me a lot of the Hank, and also just how fucking mad and obsessed that the Popeye gets with the frogs he's hunting.
Yeah.
You know, that scene where I actually think that's my favorite scene in the movie, where this guy is just giving him the slip, you know, like, mm-hmm. he's fallen on the, he's been made, he's fallen him on the train. he's trying to break contact and like all the different things you can do that. And I thought that was really cool. And the scene where he finally pulls it off, and I was like, man, as a cop, why would you show the bad guy how pissed off you are? But he's like right. pitching a fucking whole fit on the subway platform, you know, twisting his head. But that all feeds into like the frankly insane behavior he gets up to the end of the film, because he will do anything to keep from being embarrassed and humiliated again.
Yeah, I feel like though that they kind of ignore the obvious in that scene, which is just get him at the next stop, and get him at the next stop becomes a thing later in the movie. So I kind of was wondering why doesn't he's got a phone right there, right? Like he steps off the subway to make a fake phone call. Just call your cop buddies and say he's going to the X stop. Meet him there.
And that's the other thing, is that because he can't arrest him, he didn't have the information. He was trying to get the information.
He's just trying to tail him. Not lose track of him.
Yeah. I just thought there's a lot of that in like how Walt would bait Hank into making a mistake, and that would buy him another season of like, you know, Hank not being suspicious of him or something. Like he would just, because I think Doyle is kind of a bad cop. Like he's got good instincts, but he's just lazy and impatient. And don't you think that they were drawing a clear comparison between the Popeye Doyle character and the French Connections American guy, that like he was, they're both like made for each other. Like they're both wanting to cut corners. They're both impatient, wanting to, you know, wanting that big bust versus wanting that big payday. And like the experienced commander and drug runner is like, you need to lay back, and like the money's going to be there tomorrow, and or the train will be at the next stop. And they both fucking just head first self-destructively pursue these dreams that they're chasing.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. I don't know, that scene is definitely the best scene in the movie in my opinion. It's even better than the chase scene that comes later with the runaway train. I think
it's close
because it's more clever, certainly, right? I mean, there's I really liked the dynamic of the guy knowing the French guy knowing that he's being tailed, Popeye knowing that the French guy knows he's being tailed, and all the cards are on the table here, right? It's just like, which one of these guys can trick the other into moving out of position? It's like in American Gladiators, when you've got to get the ball from one side of the field and slam dunk it in the goal in the other, and you got Blaze and you got Ball Crusher, I think is one of them. Between you
Blaze
and the goal.
You did not want to take that field and see Blaze and Ball Crusher together. Oh my God. No.
And you head fake one of them and you spin around the other and you made it, right? Like it's that dynamic, like just tricking the other person into being out of position enough that you can get out of the situation.
Yeah, the fake outs around the trash cans and getting on and getting off the cars. And there's even like a really clever shot where the bad guy waits on a corner that I think he knows is one of those like two picture windows transparent. So when Gene Hackman keeps watching, he's kind of like caught. He rounds a corner and like, oh shit. And they like kind of briefly make eye contact, and it's like, guy made him. I really like, it's one of the reasons I like spy films. I don't like spy films so much for the shoot 'em up, pow, pow, but like the dead drops and the codes and just the really most of the spy craft stuff is just discipline. Mm-hmm. Like you have to do these crazy things, these unnatural things every day the same way. And if you ever stop and you ever take a shortcut, that's when they get you. Yeah. And the fact that like 99 times out of 100, no one's watching. But you got to maintain that discipline. Mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating. And kind of almost the same way of like a 3-hour race where a guy's going 200 miles an hour, just turning left the whole time. Like that's like mind numbingly boring, but also like life. And I think that's the kind of stuff is really fascinating, that maintaining an edge in those extreme conditions.
Yeah. And when you condense it down to, you know, a 5-10 minute scene here, it is exciting. It is very exciting.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
One thing that they did throughout this movie that I didn't quite understand, maybe you have some ideas, is they constantly drop the dialogue out, which I think is supposed to make you feel like you're one of the agents that are tailing or somebody, because you're like constantly trying to strain to see if you're missing something, or you feel like, you know, like, oh, these are the two bad guys that are having a conversation. Am I missing something? Or the two bad guys' point of view looking at Gene Hackman and his partner discussing, are they missing something? Mm-hmm. But then during the famous car chase, they also just show so many scenes of Gene Hackman wordlessly screaming and swearing in the car cabin that I'm not sure it was thematic, and it's just they didn't have people mic'd up and they didn't want to do ADR.
No, I immediately noticed it. It's the first thing I noticed in this movie is that they would shoot scenes where people are clearly talking without dialogue in them. And I was questioning, what is this about? And I think it gets to some kind of level of like almost around the conversation. That's another Hackman movie that we watched not too long ago, which the whole aesthetic of that is exactly that, right? Yeah. It's like spot hearing conversations, piecing together things, bits of conversation you hear. I don't think this movie is really trying to get there, but it does something interesting with its aesthetic, with its, like, I guess, sound aesthetic, that made me feel like, I was part of this. I don't even want to call it spying ring. They're not spying.
Sting.
They're just
it's a cat and mouse
operation, whatever it is. Yeah.
Maybe, and actually now that I'm thinking about it, maybe the Gene Hackman screaming and swearing in the car is to put you in like a pedestrian perspective of like, I'm just staying on the side of the road and this guy is driving down like a maniac. What is he doing? What, he's not even chasing. Like, and you look on the street, it's like, what the fuck? There's no one obviously is chasing, and look back and there's no one chasing him. What the hell is he doing? And he's chasing the train that's racing above.
I like that they put him in a civilian car for that, because he doesn't have sirens. He doesn't have any way to communicate, hey, I'm a cop doing this. I have the law on my side. He's just a maniac in those scenes.
He's a maniac. What he does have is the horn.
He uses constantly.
The horn is almost funny. Like, he uses it like the siren. He's just for 5 minutes. He does not stop honking this thing.
Yeah.
Did you do it? So this is the famous race that this movie's is based around. It's the him versus the L train. The runaway L train. Did you do any research about this?
No.
So apparently, they arranged this stunt driving thing where they were like arranging all these like near misses, and I want to talk about the camera effects that they used to pull that off. But in the wide shots, I guess the stunt driver lost control of the car and actually smashed into things several times.
Nice.
And they decided it looked so cool that they just left it. So, like, there's authentic car crashes in this movie. And it looks cool. It's like the car chase equivalent of like an Indiana Jones scene where Gene Hackman, he's not a professional stunt driver. He's not like this cop is just doing whatever he can to keep up with this train. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple scenes that really work where there's like this weird POV shot that I hear that they undercrank the camera for to really the increase the sense of speed.
Yeah.
But they're doing, you know, he's driving around to fruit stands and stuff, but they do like, you know, lady crossing with a baby carriage. And I'm like, oh my God, I think Gene Hackman's just going to run this baby over. And what is he going to do then?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't, but they constantly play with that. And it yeah. pays off. They actually pays off in like, oh my God, he actually did that moment.
Uh-huh.
But all the camera techniques that they used in like the real crashes, like you said, the civilian cars, and it was these crowded streets. Like, did they get permits for this, or did they just kind of just run this down underneath the Brooklyn L train? I thought it definitely. And the thing is, it happened late in the movie because like the whole time I'm like, well, where's this famous car chase? Mm-hmm. I almost had talked myself into like, you must have misremembered. You've gotten something. But like it hits like at the 75% mark, and it is something. It is something else.
Yeah. It's real good. I felt for the guy whose car he stole, commandeered.
Stole. Destroyed.
Sure.
Hey, well, man, when am I going to get this back?
Yeah. Never. It's almost better that he did destroy this car so thoroughly and completely, because like otherwise, what are you getting compensation for, like a transmission that's going to go out in 6 months
because
up? Your pistons are all damaged at this point because of how hard he revved your fucking engine. Your tires are ruined, your brakes are shot.
You took a red line for 5 minutes. Right? Yeah,
you're never going to get compensated for that. But when he fucking totals it, yeah, you could probably get compensated for that. At least he's getting a new car out of that.
Yeah,
so good for him.
And I just thought that, like, again, I can't oversell how much it looked like there was real danger. You know, they used with like a little bit of a zoom lens, a little bit of a low POV, a little bit of undercranking, and it just gives you this effect of him just barely making through traffic from a first person view. And it's like one of those things where like it triggered that like grab the dash reflex of me.
Yeah.
Like I was reaching for the oh Jesus handle on the side of the door, like, cause it's like you feel like a passenger driving with a maniac. Mm-hmm. And they constantly show like Gene Hackman's silent, like impotent face of rage as he's screaming and yelling and getting frustrated. It's such a great linear progression of him getting going over the line. Like it starts with him stamping and acting like a jackass on the subway platform. He beats this train to the next stop and he thinks he's got him. And then the train blows through the stop because this other guy's commandeered the whole fucking train, matching his insanity. And it leads up to where Gene Hackman kills that guy in cold blood, right?
Yes. I mean, sure. Yeah, he shoots him.
Although
in the back.
I guess. I was trying to think, because my first thought is like, oh, wow, he's crossed the line. But I'm like, I guess if this guy, he's already killed, like, what, a train conductor, two cops and stuff. So, like, maybe you can authorize the use of deadly force, because what, this guy takes over another subway, maybe 1,000 people die.
Well, but he can't know that, right? He's not on that train.
I guess that's true. He doesn't know, because does he not have a radio? I guess he wouldn't in the 70s have a radio like that. You'd need a car-based radio.
I mean, I wouldn't. And even if he could have a radio, where's he going to carry it while he's tailing a guy, right? He's going to have one of those shoulder-mounted radios. Be like, yeah.
Although I thought he knew something was up when the train didn't stop.
When
the train just goes tearing through the station.
Knows that he's murdered people. But still, yeah, he's a criminal who's fleeing. I don't shoot him in the back, maybe, but also keep chasing him.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly
going to get away.
Oh, no. So that whole chase, never mind. That whole chase starts with him shooting at him from the rooftop. He tries to snipe him to death, right? And he does kill somebody.
Oh, that's That's right.
Yeah, so
that's
he totally right. knows. This is justified. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if the guy's running away, like you set up a sniper nest and start taking pot shots at people.
And that's, murder somebody in the street. Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Some lady got it.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, you know, stay away from the body, don't help her. You know, mm-hmm. like that was a pretty intense scene too. Also, I did not expecting what an athletic performance that Gene Hackman puts in.
Yeah,
like what, he was
so he and I share a birthday, which is crazy. Except we're 52 years apart, exactly. he was born in 1930.
Oh, God, he's 91, yeah, he's 91 years old.
Going on 92.
So he was 41 in this movie.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, not bad for a 41-year-old man. I'm not sure I could run like that, and I'm only just going on 40. Yeah. So
running guys down on foot in a Santa Claus costume, I thought that was, like, I wish I... Like, you know, he looks like Santa with this tracking down his naughty list or something. But yeah, he did, like, in that scene where he's evading the sniper, he did, like, some pretty impressive combat roles and...
Jumping over railings, you know, and...
I don't know if some of that was stuntman work or not, but it looked like Gene Hackman rolling around mm-hmm. and doing somersaults and shit.
One other Breaking Bad thing that I noticed in this movie is the drug testing they were doing felt like very crystal blue persuasion kind of.
Yeah.
Not glamorizing it so much, but like taking its time showing you how this process works with.
And probably something that most American audiences would feel like, you know, like you have no idea what it looks like to what a meth lab looks like. Right. And then Breaking Bad shows you like this idea of doing the drug test and like 180, mm-hmm. we're going into orbit, 190, we're blasting off.
And just like taking the thermometer and putting a rubber band around it and putting a needle on the front of it. And it shows you all this right with the beakers and the mineral oils and tinctures.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah. It's felt insider. Like, you know, like if you're like a middle American audience, like, oh, I'm watching a drug movie, you know? Yeah.
I mean, tell me that the cooking in the camper doesn't get directly inspired by this scene.
Oh, 100%. The close up insert and all the. Yeah, is Gene Hackman secretly the king of all voyeur movies?
Yes.
Like, who else you got in that race? You got Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, I'm
okay,
you
got, Rear you know, Window.
Rear Window.
Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart. Thank you. Gene Hackman. Like, in the conversation was like 1972, wasn't it?
Yeah. Or
might have been later because it looked like Gene Hackman was older in that movie.
Pretty early, I thought.
1974.
Yeah.
So, essentially back to back movies, he's in things about Gene Hackman invading people's privacy.
Yeah. He was just really into the whole thing. You know,
he was on the wrong, he was on the wrong side of the law in the other movie, or I guess he was a contractor rather than an officer of the law. But I thought that was a funny scene too, that the him and Roy Scheider like listening in to the stupid conversations of the criminals and laughing their ass off to Jet. I did notice you mentioned the music, which I think in this movie is excellent. It starts off just like punching you in the face. Like there's no studio logo. Yeah. There's nothing. It's just loud noises, music. But I thought there was a lot of like Cowboy Bebop in this movie, or maybe Cowboy Bebop's got a lot of this in its movie.
Jazz feel to it.
Directly propelling the action forward, you know, making it snappy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really like the music. It's not conventional. I think that's another thing that Breaking Bad kind of did too, right? It doesn't have a conventional like soundtrack with you know, strings and then have a big choir or whatever, or it's using a lot of sort of natural sounds as music. That's probably partly inspired by this movie as well.
The last big theme, I don't know if you have it, others. The last big theme I want to talk about before I just have some, I guess, random observations is this war on drugs. You know, like I know this isn't the first. I think you had Bullet is about around the same time, which I also haven't seen.
I haven't either.
But they were kind of like, you know, these and then these kind of crime movies peak in the late 70s and 80s with the increasing crime and violence we saw in the cities. gee, I wonder if there's a casual link between the Prohibition and this. And it made me think about two things. One, it feels like these cops and robber movies are generated by times of Prohibition. Like, you got Elliot Ness and the Untouchables and Dick Tracy and all the mobster movies of the 30s and 40s as a reaction to Prohibition.
Yeah.
And then you got away from that. Then you had like Westerns and war movies and things like that. And then sure enough, in the late 60s, 70s, with the war on drugs starting and the panic over that, you started getting stuff like this. There's something like kind of charmingly naive, like the fact that the feel of this movie is that the cops have almost won the drug war. They've got sure. the New York is a heroin desert. Mm-hmm. The junkies are out there. They're like, if one more week of no heroin and they're going to go clean and sober and start being actively productive to society again. Yeah. This goddamn French connection, these goddamn French bastards we can keep out of the city. We've done it. But it's wild because like 4/5 of the movie feels very raw, raw kind of Sicario. Like we're less cynical Sicario. We're doing the right thing. It's kind of, you know, like, Elliot Ness against obviously bad guy. But then Gene Hackman starts like kills a federal agent because he's sloppy. And then the final title cards where essentially Patsy's went down and did like unjust amounts of, like, the guy that gets tricked into taking a car across the ocean, it happens to be stuff full of heroin. He didn't know that, right? Like, that guy literally was just taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think
he gets like 5 years in prison. The one guy gets killed, and the guy who's making the money and is at the top of the thing, he gets off scot-free.
Yeah.
And
goes back to his fucking castle in France.
And Roy Scheider and Gene Hackman get reassigned and taken off the narc force. And I'm like,
right,
that's actually a surprisingly sophisticated, nuanced, and cynical take on the war on drugs for 1971. But it happens all at the end of the film.
Well, I think there's other stuff in there too. Like, I'm with you. Like, most of the movie feels like the cops think they've beaten it. But there's also the scene where he goes into the black bar and just starts roughing people up and starts.
Oh, yeah.
It's all a cover to talk to his informant. But also, if you look at the drugs that are lined up on that bar, because he shakes everybody down, right? He tests everybody up against the wall. He says, put all your shit. Everybody starts dropping their stuff on the floor. It's all pills and just like tons of drugs. Everybody's got drugs.
You have pills, you got heroin. Powder, and you also have catnip, you know, like, which is supposed to be weed, I think, and baggies.
But it's all, there are still tons of drugs. It's just, okay, so nobody has heroin. Now people are popping pills. Now people are smoking weed. Now people are doing any other thing they can get their hands on. Because what you're doing here is you're trying to eliminate a human behavior that has, you know, causes and symptoms that you're not even addressing or not even considering addressing. So, like, yeah, I think the movie is trying to say that, okay, maybe they've squashed heroin because they've taken all their laser focus and put it onto heroin. And that's the one thing that they've kept out. But everybody's got everything else. They've just moved from heroin to something else.
Yeah, and I guess when I think about, like, also the corrosive elements of this drug trade, you know, that, like, Gene Hackman, it is all a sham. But, like, these attitudes, these essentially racist attitudes of the police, and it's not, like, specifically racist, but, like, hey, there's drug trades in these neighborhoods. These neighborhoods tend to be a certain disposition, and we're increasing our police action there, and that increases how much crime. Like, you can see how, and this is something that, like, if you're a fan of The Wire, you know, like, that, like, it seems like one of the theses is that the war on drugs is what made cops kind of, like, sloppy and lazy. That like even Gene Hackman's commander screaming at the beginning of the movie, it's like, all you guys are doing is like ripping off junkies and calling it a big bust. Like, you're not doing anything and attacking at the source. And
yeah, you're just inflating your numbers. That's it.
But I think what they didn't know then that we do know now and we're still doing it is, like, whatever the government interdicts is just going to be vastly overwhelmed by the flood that comes in, because like all you need is one kind of foolish young man or woman to, you know, take a kilo in the briefcase or, you know, what. Like, there's so many ways you can smuggle this in. And even if the government gets 50%, the profit margins are so much that, like, it's just never, ever going to stop.
Mm-hmm. No, the demand is there. The demand is there. Supply will meet it.
And the fact that there's people out there, like, you know, filling their veins full of junk and wasting their lives is not because of the availability of this drug. It's because of other issues. And if all the junkies, like, ran out of heroin, like you said, they'd move on to pills or they'd move on to alcohol, and they, or they move on to, you know, huff and paint or whatever, you know, like they'll go to wherever and you can't interdict it all the time, not in a free society.
No.
But yeah, that's the thing. It's like, so it's like watching this like frozen in amber movie, and it feels relevant, but it's depressing instead of like,
it's depressing because it's 1971. And somebody is talking about this and pointing it out, and here we are in 2021, and we're just now getting to a place where people even consider this to be a huge problem, right? Like,
looking back at all the damage done, people were talking
about how bad this was, the drug war was for our society,
right? Yeah, because we were still learning, like, you know, the, I still don't know that we've learned a lesson, like, you know, the next designer drug that comes out, or you know, is the next thing that people get panicked about. It doesn't seem like, and even like as we get a little bit more laxer on like marijuana, it seems like there's no movement on any of the other stuff, and now fentanyl's and everything. It's just fucking crazy,
right? Are we just designing a system that pushes people toward abusing the drugs that the government sanctions? Like, okay, you're gonna abuse the alcohol, okay, you're gonna abuse the opioids. Because these are things that you can get without smuggling.
Perfectly capable of fucking up people's lives.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Here's an open question I have every time I watch a movie from the 60s and 70s. Did people just not know what blood looked like?
Bright red. Bright.
Bright, like the blood. I'm holding up a pair of scissors. This is the color of blood in this movie. Like, oh, I just got shot in the head. Like, what? What?
I blame
what?
Dawn of the Dead. That was much later. It has bad blood. Yeah, you're right.
I almost wonder if it's intentionally fake. Like, the audiences, if they actually had real blood, would have, like, passed the fuck out or, like, rioted or something, because there's no way that they just didn't know what blood looked like. Yet, super unrealistic every single time I see it. It's crazy. Yeah. It's like stop-motion Play-Doh blood.
I have a question for you.
Yeah?
What the absolute hell does picking your feet in Poughkeepsie mean? This movie did not give me the context to appreciate what the hell he's talking about.
I think he's talking about something uncouth or backwards, like someone from Poughkeepsie, which is that like a, was that known as a kind of a, like, what kind of town is Poughkeepsie? Is it like a bumpkin town
know.
And you're picking your feet? Like, it's like uncouth to take your, and that implies that you've taken your shoes and socks off in a public area and you're picking at your toes and you're going at the toe knife, like Always Sunny or some shit.
They say it a couple of times, yeah, in this movie, and I did not get it.
I did not get that either. Is it a hateful stereotype to show French people literally skipping through the streets of France with naked baguettes?
No. Not at all. The French society revolves around
open air bread. It's not wrapped up. There's no paper.
You just got
a man with unwashed hands handling your bread, grabbing your bread, and then skipping through the streets with a big old 3 foot long baguette, just carrying it through the streets.
Look, 1971. You know, this is before the AIDS epidemic. I think people were a lot less cautious about how they handled their
primary vector of AIDS is unsafe baguette handling. Right. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, they're elongated cylindrical foods. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I thought that it was very distracting. Like, just people walking around with the you put it in a bag, you know, you love your bread so much. Take care of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I objected far more to the use of the word frog in this movie. I would say that's as, you know, not as bad given the social context or cultural context it has here, but pretty bad. It's someone can no easier change their nationality than they can their race.
I always thought frog was, but I don't know. Like, I feel like all the slurs for European white people are just like no one takes seriously in this country anymore. So
sure.
Until that changes, it's like, you know, it's like, yeah,
but
frog kraut. You know, I don't need French people, but I'm a German.
Yeah,
kraut, whatever. You know, what else?
Because I'm
I would kind
never
of
call anyone I'm, any of those names, but okay,
you wouldn't.
No,
you wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
Gee whiz, I thought we were good friends, Jim. I thought you could call me your kraut. But
no, only if we're, you know, if we're in a barbershop and you've got a German haircut guy
and Clint Eastwood is cutting her hair. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Sure. All right. That sounds good. Anything else you want to say about this film? Because my podcast vehicle is smashed up and out of gas.
What do you think about Roy Scheider in this movie?
That's the biggest surprise. He is just a guy. I actually thought that he would be a presence, that there would be like a real, like when I saw that, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a fun buddy cop and he's going to be like a real foil to like it. But no, he's just it feels like Gene Hackman's sidekick.
Yeah.
And except for if he was like a real sidekick, he would be in more of the movie.
In the way that like Miller's sidekick feels like Miller's sidekick in The Expanse, right? Like he's at Havelock is in it for like 2 minutes. And then that's kind of it.
Yeah. I was shocked that he wasn't a bigger part of the movie for sure.
Me too. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. Did not win it.
Get the fuck out of here. What? I definitely see why this movie is highly regarded. I was a little blown away by how much Oscar gold was thrown at this movie.
It won five Oscars. Best Picture, Best Actor in a Leading Role for Gene Hackman, Best Director for William Friedkin, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing, and was nominated for three more. Roy Scheider did not win one of those three.
And it's a great film. I'm not trying to say it's not. I'm just like, man, it felt like one of those of the moment films where it's like this war on drugs was really new, and this was a grittier, a little bit more cynical take on it. Maybe the violence was shocking too, like that lady getting murdered in broad daylight by a sniper. The vehicular violence. Someone gets shot in the face, and again they had the red Play-Doh blood, but like his whole face just gets covered. Like it, I thought that was, you know, pretty shocking for the time too. When was Psycho made?
Oh, like 60? Oh no, it's later than I thought it was, isn't it?
It's 1960, but like, isn't it kind of wild that 11 years before this, the amount of blood in Psycho was such that like one of the reasons that Hitchcock shot it in black and white is because he thought it would be too shocking and offensive.
Yeah.
And in this movie, someone gets shot in the face covered. And again, it's just interesting how, you know, we always talk about in terms of America, how like comfortable you are with like gratuitous violence, but we're uncomfortable with sex. Mm-hmm. That's a really recent phenomenon. Like that started in the 70s and like has gone light and you know, obviously the sex side hasn't kept up, but like we were kind of like prudish in general until late 60s, early 70s. And it was Katie barred the door. So,
but it's rated except R, for so you can get away
full
with
full frontal male nudity. That's still pretty tabooist boo.
Yeah, Hackman has yet to do that. I'm hoping 92 will be the year that
92,
he decides.
The year of the dong. That's what we're looking for.
Anyway, I think that's all I have to say about this movie. I was not as impressed. I've seen things like The Departed, right? The Departed's cat and mouse game is so much better than this movie. But
yeah, and it's a better looking film.
50 years later, what do I want?
And that's the thing is like this is a dreary film. It's not very colorful. It's filmed in the winter of New York, so everything's kind of dull and gray, and people are huddled in, and that's kind of suits the aesthetic. So it's not a very pretty film, but like you said, the kinetic nature, like the way they do the filming of the foot chases, where it's like 1 second of like just like it looks like Gene Hackman running at the speed of light because the background, the camera's locked on him and the background's just flying by, cut to the who he's chasing, every second just cut back and forth to the beat. It's got and some of the scenes of him again like rushing through I don't even know how they do a dolly tracking shot so smooth through that crowded of a subway. Like they must have had the people just part in like the Red Sea behind the guy racing backwards at the camera. But it gives you, it really, like, even from foot chase to car chase to train chase, they use these techniques that just make it seem like this is just runaway, you know, train of a movie. And I think it's worth it for that. And I think you also get a good kick out of it if you're a Breaking Bad fan. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, this is one of those movies that, like, his pedigree is so high and it's so highly spoken of, I think I got too excited for it.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh boy, this is going to be good, and it was just, and it is good, but it's just, it's aged. It's an old movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's great like it. In the way that some of the other movies of that era that we've watched have been, like a Psycho.
Yeah, right. Like that Hitchcock stuff that's held up so well. Even if there's some fuddy duddy filming techniques and stuff, the core of it, and maybe that's the thing is like this is just like it's hard to say something new about the war on drugs 50, 60 years on. And this movie is one of the very first kind of, are we sure we're doing this right? And like, goddamn, it's a trip watching it 50 years on. All right. French Connection. Well, you know, I'd love to tell you what we're going to be doing next, but we've recently turned this over to more capable hands selecting the prestige film. what we're doing now is, if you are an executive producer level patron, you have the opportunity to vote on which podcast we're going to do for the prestige feeds for now, next week. It's not like a totally open vote. Jim and I are going to select from a list of movies, like three that we would be interested in doing, and then we're going to present them on a vote on patreon.com/baldmove. Jim, what are the three movies people are voting on this week?
We've got a stellar selection here. You get to vote on Twister, which we'll see. We'll see how this goes. But Twister, Fargo, and A Time to Kill.
Cows? There's cows.
In Fargo? Probably, yeah.
Probably, but definitely in Twister.
Probably not A Time to Kill.
Twister, Fargo, and A Time to Kill. Those are your choices. If you're an executive producer or want to be an executive producer up in Patreon, go to patreon.com/baldmove and vote, and we'll do the podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.